On the Wintrust Business Lunch, this is John Williams. It's 12:09. Pete Zimmerman's our producer. A lot of ground to cover today. We appreciate you joining us here on WGN Radio. We start, as we often do, with Michael Miller, the economist, who joined us not that long ago, not just on this show, but on my weekday 9 to noon show, the associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Michael, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, John. Great to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about the jobs numbers right now and the direction they're going. I know you've been paying attention to that. What's the bright spot or what's the gloom about all of this?
Well, there actually is some typical two-handed economist, right? There are some bright spots. The number on the weekly basis is falling. But, you know, the weekly one can be kind of noisy, so a lot of us look at four-week moving averages. And for 14 weeks in a row, that weekly average, the four-week average, has fallen. And that's a good trend. So we know that things are moving in the right direction in terms of first-time claims. When you look at continuing claims, you see the same thing. You see a decline occurring. The only thing that's a little bit troubling about that is there's a chance that a bunch of the people who are falling off of the unemployment compensation rolls are because they run out of their benefits. We don't give benefits forever. It's usually for 13 or 26 weeks. And so we have some good news, bad news. The numbers are falling, but it could be because, not necessarily, but because people are just losing the benefit.
So if we, say, extended or had another round of unemployment benefit legislation, would more people magically appear on those rolls then?
Yes, they would. Then they would reapply, and then they would be able to have those benefits for another period, whatever period that the government comes up with. We did this during the Great Recession. In fact, we kept increasing until it got to the point it was, I believe, for 99 continuous weeks, where the normal would be 26. And the reason they did that, of course, is because things were so bad. We had almost no choice. Americans would have gone almost literally hungry without that kind of support.
Well, then I wonder what the real unemployment is. Is there a number that sort of takes into account the people that aren't on the rolls?
There are. When the unemployment figures come out monthly from the Department of Labor, there's the one they report is called U3, and that's the one that's down to, you know, what, 7-point-some percent. But they also have broader measures which ask people about why are you not working, and are you discouraged, and have you stopped looking, and things like this. All those numbers are higher, but they're moving in the same direction. They're declining in the same way that the overall unemployment rate is falling.
Do they break it down in relative to the kind of money those people make? Are high-wage earners more or less unemployed than low-wage earners?
Oh, the numbers in this particular pandemic are stunning. High-wage earners have not been affected dramatically by this event. And we have, for those of us who have pretty decent jobs like that, we've returned practically to normal, whereas the people at the bottom are really still hurting. They're down pretty dramatically. So this was a blue collar downturn, and it continues to affect blue collar big time, especially in areas like hospitality. Although the Beige Book shows us that hospitality is beginning to come back some, and especially in the Chicago area, which is good news. But these people are still hurting because hours are down. Even if they're back at work, they're not getting their full complement of hours per week.
You're describing the K-shaped recovery, aren't you?
Yes. Unfortunately, I had never seen one. I've been in this business for a long time, and I've never heard that particular description. But this pandemic has caused us to look at things through different lenses, and the idea of a K-shape is a very interesting way of putting it, that it is affecting people dramatically differently.
People on the top are getting better, and the poor are not getting better. They're getting poorer. So then if you are managing a second round of stimulus or unemployment benefits, I guess we've tried to target the people that earn less money, right?
That is the key. The key is the target. And then one thing you do is when you target, if you have only a certain amount you can spend, if you make sure you target the people who need it the most, in a sense, you can give them more. We can take, say, $1 trillion and do much more good with it if we make sure that the people who get the money are the ones who truly need the money. And we could be more generous with those to get them through this rough time.
I think I've asked you this before, Michael. I wonder what that target is. What's the number that best does that?
Yeah, that's the hard thing, you know. It could be that somebody is an employee and as their hours are cut, but maybe there's one or two other people inside the household who also are still earning money, and it's really, really hard to do. But we do know that those making less than, say, $16 an hour and so forth were the most dramatically hurt by this. And therefore, what you could do is you can annualize that number and make sure that those are the people that get the biggest support.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Thanks for your time today, Michael.
It was my pleasure.
Ian Schur joins us, editor-at-large at CNET. Hi, Ian. Welcome back. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Good. Let's jump into what's going on in the Silicon Valley, the workforce there. We seem to be paying so much attention to that little slice of pie, which is really a big slice of pie, right? Not that many companies, but wow, do they get a lot of our attention when we talk about markets and the economy in general.
Totally. You know, I think what's been interesting is that we've been seeing that a lot of Silicon Valley has been on kind of the under the microscope because of the way they handle employees. You know, we all know about the really nice benefits they get, the free meals, the doing your laundry, all sorts of stuff. And a lot of those benefits have actually expanded out to other companies around the country. There's now a lot of people get IVF treatments through their company and stuff like that. A lot of that started in the tech world. But one of the things that's interesting is as they've all been working from home, as a lot of us have been, what a recent survey found was that at least 68% of tech workers feel they're more burned out now than they did when they were working at the office. And it's a higher number now than back in February. And I think it speaks a little bit to how we're all responding to this experience. You know, a lot of people, we've heard that productivity is up across the board in this country. And I have personally attributed that to a lot of people feeling like they need to prove to their bosses that they're actually working and they're not just slacking off at home.
Yeah.
And it's led a lot of people to feel burnout, and it's a tough one to deal with.
It's not work at home, it's live at work. And
It is. Live at work. You made a very good point. Exactly.
Well, and I think, I come into the office, I'll just use myself as an example. I come into the office every day, and we've been working longer hours and harder than we ever have at this radio station. I think a lot of people are doing a good job, and we're saving our skin and helping our sponsors. Hooray! But then, at least when we go home, we get to sort of close the door and watch TV or not work, more or less.
Yeah.
And if I guess I was working at home, I would never get that sort of physical break, would I, Ian?
No, you'd have a 15-second commute, which is wonderful, but you would never be able to get away from it. And look, this is something we've written about on CNET before. Our mobile devices and the way that work has changed over the last decade have already made this a problem, right? Like, this is not new to the pandemic. People have felt like they can't get away from work for a long time. And in fact, it's led some European countries, most notably France, to write new laws saying that if a person says that they're off the clock, that they are off the clock. You can't force them to work when they're at home. And I think it's those types of things that we're still going up against and we're still dealing with. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, we at CNET, when we've talked about how to set up your work environment at home and how to deal with all of this, we recommend you kind of single out a part of your home or your apartment as the workspace.
Mm.
So that way you get away from it, right? You have a physical distance from quote-unquote work when you're done, and that's a really important thing to do.
By the way, just to be completely transparent, when I get home, I keep working. I bug my producer when she's at home, and I share text messages and email with my boss when we're at home. I think it's that way with all of our producers and hosts here, and I think really what we're talking about is something that we should all pay attention to. Pre-COVID, we should have been paying attention to this.
Exactly.
Facebook
exactly.
has rejected, I'm just looking at a story here, and I don't think this is right. Facebook says it rejected 2,200 or million ads?
Million. Yeah.
Really? Let me finish the headline, then you tell me what I'm reading.
Sure.
Facebook says it rejected 2.2 million ads for breaking political campaign rules. Political campaign rules are so easy. You get to lie in political ads. So what possibly are they doing that 2.2 million times they had to get rejected.
A lot of it has actually been around obstructing voting. You know, one of the biggest problems we ran across in 2016 was that at the end, right, as we were nearing the final stretch, we started seeing these posts and ads go up that actually were lying to people about how to vote, right? There was a number of people who were told you can text and vote, right? You can literally vote in your text. And of course, that's not true. You can't vote by website either. And those types of things caused a ton of trouble. So what Facebook says is that a number of obstructionist ads that are, you know, went through Facebook as political ads, they had to reject because of that. There's also been a real effort by Facebook to make sure that when there is a political ad, that it is somehow verifiable, right? You're not allowed to say one of the candidates is a lizard, right? Like you have to, and that's actually an ad that someone put up about Mark Zuckerberg once. So it's those types of things that really Facebook is trying to deal with. And of course it's caused a ton of debate in this country around free expression and all these things, but there are actually rules around political ads on the airwaves too. Yes. They are allowed to lie, unfortunately, but there are rules that they can't pass, and Facebook has been increasingly trying to at least make the rules the same as it is on TV.
Apple Music TV, so this sounds like what MTV was when it first started.
Right? No kidding. They're starting a 24-hour music video live stream, and they actually began it earlier this week. Today, it's all Bruce Springsteen to celebrate his upcoming album. They're going to have some exclusive premieres on Friday. And it's really funny because, like, first off, MTV already exists, but also that, you know, Apple is not known as a media company, right? They're known as a tech company. And they have had mixed results going into the media world, even though we think of them as a huge media company because they have streaming and they sell us music and they sell us movies. But this is a whole new thing, and I'm really curious to see if people really like it. You know, the MTV changed the way we look at music, and streaming has changed the way we consume music. So I'm really curious to see if Apple is onto something, or if maybe they missed the boat. I don't know.
Let me ask you about one thing real quick, too. You guys have a story at CNET. If you're voting by mail, how to track your vote or your ballot, is that right?
Yes, in almost every state, you can actually track your ballot like a FedEx package. And it, by the way, including Illinois. And the most important thing is that a lot of people, I think there's survey after survey shows a lot of people are anxious about whether or not their vote might get thrown out. By the way, if you're voting by mail, as a veteran voter by mail myself, I want to remind everyone, use your driver's license signature, not the signature you use at the grocery store, because they actually check those against driver's license records, and if yours doesn't fit, match, they toss it out because they think it's fake. So a lot of people are anxious about what could happen, and there are ways to track your ballot through system, and we put together a list on CNET, of course, to make it really easy for you. But I think a lot of people aren't even aware of that, so we wanted to make sure people knew.
Ian Schur, editor at large, always a pleasure. Ian, thanks for joining us at CNET.com. You can read more of this CNET.com. Thanks, Ian.
Take care.
Yeah. People at the Illinois State Board of Elections told us use your careful signature. When you sign your driver's license, you probably did. If you use your careful signature, it will match. And if it's not perfect, if you got a middle initial in there on one and you didn't the other, they're not checking it letter for letter. They're just checking it to see if you are the same person. And your careful signature on one is probably enough like your careful signature on the other. Jamie Guth joins us on WGN. Let's, as we usually do, start with the airline industry and what you're looking at there, Amy.
Yeah, that's right. So an interesting test has been done. And United Airlines, they piloted a mobile app called Common Pass. They did this on a flight from London Heathrow Airport to Newark Liberty International in New Jersey. And essentially it's an app that has your coronavirus testing status in it. So it's potentially a way to standardize a lot of paperwork from a lot of people at borders. But I think the hope here of the airline would be that this would be a way that people could say, hey, look, here's my app. I am corona negative, and bypass the quarantine and perhaps encourage travel. So that is kind of the hope there. Again, the app is called Common Pass Mobile. It was created by Commons Project Foundation and the World Economic Forum, And it has many purposes. It's been used, interestingly, as a way for East African truck drivers to show that they have all their vaccinations as they're crossing nearby national borders. So it's been used there. It was formed in 2018 with funding from the Rockefeller Foundation. So it's not, some kind of fly-by-night operation. It's well-funded with some credible organizations behind it. You know, I think immediately it brings some privacy advocates have concerns about what does that entail? What does that look like? I think those are questions to be asked and answered. But it's an interesting idea if that could, you know, there's been a lot of pressure on both sides of the Atlantic, certainly from airlines, about opening up certain key routes to get some air travel kind of moving again. So I think it's really interesting. They did a trial earlier this month on Cathay Pacific from Hong Kong to Singapore. That seemed to go well, so they moved to this other one. Essentially, you go to the airport, so people at Heathrow who are flying to Newark, they took a coronavirus test, and then the results get uploaded right there into the app. So they also cited that, you know, this is a way that you could cut down on identity frauds. You couldn't borrow someone else's paperwork saying, look, I'm COVID negative, I'm all good. This would be an app. It's probably tied to biometric data like your fingerprint or something in order to access it. But I think this will be really interesting if this, you know, depending on how this test, how everyone feels it went, if there's widespread adoption, this will be something to watch very closely, I feel, for airlines and for lots of other applications.
Seems like last time we talked about this, it was that the airlines or maybe at O'Hare you could get the test, but the cost was as much as $250.
Yeah, there was a test that was being offered for people going from SFO to Hawaii, because Hawaii said, okay, you can come here, but you got to take a COVID test, and it's got to be from a place that we feel is reputable. And that was costing people upwards of $250, which, you know, that's a pretty big chunk of change. So you would do it at the airport. So I think this is kind of that same kind of thinking that airlines are kind of saying, well, if we can prove that we're only bringing healthy people across borders, would that change some of these, you know, stricter quarantines? Could we say you could bypass quarantine if you have a negative COVID test within, say, 24 hours of getting on the aircraft?
Yeah, if there were a universally accepted app, everybody says, okay, what's on there is legit, then it probably takes the need to get it done at the airport at an exorbitant cost, if you ask me. You could have gotten it from the county or the city for free or your local doctor or whatever, but I guess as long as you're within the window and the app would calculate all of this, right, Amy, it would get you on the plane. I like the sound of that.
You know, and I think earlier in the pandemic there was a little bit of talk of what kind of proof of health status would look like, and some privacy advocates sort of, you know, weighed in on some concerns with that. So I think figuring out that right place where it's safely stored data, but it's also helping travelers know that they're able to do so safely and get to loved ones or go on business, you know, ventures, whatever they're trying to do, you know, I think that might change the conversation for airlines quite a bit.
Let's talk a little bit about FedEx, UPS, some of those companies that are shipping so many products, and it's not even the big Christmas crush. What are you hearing about that?
Oh, boy. So leadership from both FedEx and UPS have really warned people, if you could just go ahead and do your holiday shopping like last week, that'd be great. They're, you know, they're really talking about, hey, during this time, we've all been home, we have moved a lot of our shopping habits online, we're already close to capacity. So they're very concerned about the holiday shopping season. There was a number that jumped out to me that I thought was really interesting in the reporting on this story, and that was from Accenture. They said 75% of consumers say that they will do at least some of their holiday shopping online this year, which is up 65% from last year. And 43% of those polled said they plan to only shop online this holiday season. So when you're looking at, you know, outlook forecasts like that, and, you know, I think it's pretty easy for people in leadership positions at UPS and FedEx to kind of start tugging at their collars a bit, thinking, oh, boy, the word that's being thrown around for this is Shipageddon, because we like to attach ageddon to all kinds of things, but Shipageddon. So they're saying if we're talking about up to 7 million packages a day between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we could face some pretty significant delays. And some analysts have been weighing in on exactly what this will look like. The moral of the story is, we should get our holiday shopping done pretty quickly, and we should be very patient with shipping time. So people that are really good at, I'm kind of pointing the finger at myself here, really good at waiting to the last minute and relying on Amazon Prime to get that quick shipping done, that is not going to be such a good option this year, because we're going to have to allow a lot of extra time. Even though these companies say they've, you know, staffed up, they've hired a lot of people this year to rise to that demand, because there's been so much extra shopping online, they're really bracing for what the holidays are going to look like. And I can only imagine what Shipageddon will look like.
And 7 million is the shortfall. That is, they're almost at capacity now. They're going to get more, meaning that with the capacity they have now, anticipating, I think I'm reading or hearing you right, Amy, then they would be behind 7 million packages a day if the current trend continues.
Yeah, so that's pretty significant when we're thinking about, you know, all the packages moving around place to place. And, you know, you and I have talked about how Amazon has invested so much, and Walmart and Target, too, just in this area for those so-called last-mile sort of distribution centers, so that not every, you know, toilet paper roll that gets ordered comes all from the same warehouse. You have some of the commonly purchased items for a given metro area already nearby. Even with that kind of thing, we're seeing FedEx and UPS already starting to warn some merchants and caution them, hey, can you bring your holiday sale up to be a little closer to Halloween than Christmas, so that we can kind of try to pace this out a little bit. They're trying to bring their sales forward. They're telling some of them, we're pretty much at capacity. We're not going to be able to do a lot extra. So I think this is going to be interesting, but I think the thing to focus on is just go knock it out. Get that shopping done. Get it shipped. Get it done. You know, go early.
Speaking of stress, I'm going to ask you about Quibi, but I also wanted to mention this text message that came into the show. We were talking about how people are trying to manage work at home and managers are trying to manage them. It says, hey, good afternoon, John. Making a comment about burnout at work at home. Several of my children are working from home an 8-hour day and having anywhere from 3 to 4 children, including very young kids, plus high schoolers, middle schoolers, trying to keep them engaged and jump up and ask them questions all day long, and families are just swamped at home. It's not just home. It's not just work. It's also school. So I can imagine the sort of tension levels or stress levels that people are going through. Thanks for the text message, 815. Quibi, I've heard that they're in trouble. What's the news with Quibi?
Oh, this is kind of a heartbreaker. I feel like Scott Catoon and I talked about Quibi so much last year on the air, and because it was going to be such a different thing, and of course we didn't have the pandemic in sight at that point, but it was essentially a streaming service that would offer entertainment and news in about 5 to 10 minute little bite-sized pieces. And if you think about how our lives were in the before time, that made sense. We were on the go, we were on the train, we were waiting for buses, we were out in the world and would be kind of looking at our phones for 5 or 10 minutes at a time, even in line in the grocery store or something. So we could watch these shows, and there were some very big names attached to it, you know, Jennifer Lopez, Chrissy Teigen, Steven Spielberg, like some big names were attached to some of these programs. They funded over 100 programs. So they really invested in this. But just 6 months in, they have said, they're calling it quits, because now is not, you know, that's the behavior change. People aren't on their phones 5 or 10 minutes at a time. People are at home, and they want a user experience they can use in their home. And so there were complaints that you couldn't watch Quibi on your television. It had to be a mobile device. There were complaints that it wasn't shareable on social media, things like that. So they are wrapping things up, which I think is kind of stunning, because there was so much, you know, fanfare around the launch. You had Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman, people with, you know, huge resumes with bringing a lot of clout to lead this organization. It raised $1.75 billion in cash, that from each of the big Hollywood studios. I mean, they had a ton of money. So Meg Whitman said, we certainly have the money to keep going for quite a long time, but we made the decision to wind it down, return the cash to our shareholders, and say goodbye to our colleagues with grace. So, I mean, I suppose you have to give them credit for knowing when to stop and saying, hey, you know what, the behavior changed, this isn't going to work. But it's kind of shocking to see it go so quickly, just 6 months after that launch. Leadership said they did try to find a buyer to no avail. They did not have any bites on that. But, you know, here's this huge company that was really, so many people put a lot of hopes in that as kind of this big future of entertainment. And then suddenly it's all different, where movie theaters are trying to stay alive and movies are getting released on apps on our TV instead. So very different world. I think it's really a matter of just terrible timing. But what a huge blow to such a big organization.
And that's what I was thinking, too. I wonder if maybe it would come back, but the timing for Quibi could not have been worse. And our time is up. Okay, Amy, thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks so much, John.